one of your Hamza apricots? Because we talked about this on the last... By the way, I haven't a clue what we were talking about last, so I'm not even going to bother trying to pick up the track of our conversation. We talked about Hamza apricots, and here is one, dried. And they're absolutely delicious.
They're incredible. There's so many things to say about the Hamza, because they were the longest-lived people in the world. And, you know, the Raj sort of took over the Hamza, which was a sort of a principality, a kingdom, between Afghanistan and Pakistan, right up at a very high altitude, I think, you know, 15,000 foot upwards. So not many things grow at that altitude. But the things that do grow are things like cherries and apricots, you know, all the things that would grow at a high altitude in a reasonably warm climate. And the people in the next valley, one side, the next valley, the other side, don't live nearly as long as the Hamza. And one of the reasons is that their water is glacial meltwater. So they call it glacial milk. Mm-hmm. Because as the glacier spirals down the mountain, it rips the mountainside out. And so the water's full of minerals, just full of them. So they water the plants with them, and so on. And there's not a lot of wood at that altitude that they want to burn. So they generally cook food lightly. And that's one of the secrets. The other is that the glacial meltwater makes the food so rich in a mineral content that, A, they taste special.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things about these apricots is that they grow wild. They haven't been hybridized. We're used to fruits where you get a bag of plums, a bag of apricots, and they all taste the same. Yeah. Every one of these is distinct.
Ooh.
Because each Ooh. One has probably come off a different tree.
Right.
And so it's great. You know, and we've forgotten, most of us, how...
Ow.
We've forgotten, most of us, that actually in the wild, every tree is different. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are quite a few places around here where there are wild plum trees growing. And you know, again, they all taste different and magnificent compared to a lot of the modern varieties. So the Hamza women were giving birth at 70 years old, right? Working in the fields at 120, right? And all the records are there. There's a wonderful book by a man called G.T. Wrench, with a W, Wrench, called The Wheel of Health. And it's all about the Hamza back in the day. And it's an old book, but you can find it online. It's quite a common book. Really worth reading, because they were incredibly long-lived.
Well, I heard your podcast that you did with G. Edward Griffin.
Oh, yes.
On cancer. And earlier on, I cracked one of these stones and got out the kernel. Tasted delicious, like an almond. And you said they're the same family. And these contain vitamin B17, is that right?
Correct.
Which is the sort of the magic ingredient, the magic vitamin.
Well, you know, there are many anti-cancer foods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, strawberries, onions, garlic, loads of them. But apricot kernels seem to be number one because of the massive content of B17. Now, you look at apricot kernels and you might read online that cyanide.
Yeah.
And cyanide smells like almonds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, but, of course, there's industrially synthesized cyanide, which can be poisonous, but cyanide that is in apricot kernels is completely benign and safe, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fantastic material. You know, it's worth reading G. Edward Griffin's book, and he wrote it, I think, back in the 80s or a long time ago.
Yeah, you would have thought, would you not, that would have been the transformative moment in the treatment, or not even the treatment, the prevention of cancer. And that, you know, we don't need to take any more of your chemotherapy or radiotherapy or your surgery, because we've misunderstood cancer, that the tumour is actually the kind of the fruit of an expression of the cancer rather than the root.
Well, the tumour is the healing process going on. So, I mean, you know, let's say you cut your hand and it's bleeding. Well, what's going to happen? You're going to leave it alone, you're not going to irritate it, And as long as you don't rub something nasty in it, it'll just heal up by itself. Yep. The healthier you are, the quicker it'll heal. Now, same is true with any inflammatory issue. Cancer is usually inflammatory, arthritis inflammatory, heart problems inflammatory. So when you've got inflammation, you've got pain. They go together. So what is inflammation? Well, it's obvious on your hand that the inflammation is part of the healing process. You know, when you heal, generally your temperature goes up, which stimulates healing. You feel tired, so you're not that active. Say you're seriously recovering. You know, the body will adjust itself to put all the emphasis on healing. Now, the problem is if you get stressed, healing stops. Healing just stops when you're stressed, because it's the fight or flight adrenaline response. So it's important that we, if you like, practice calmness. You know, if you find yourself worrying about something, which might be an assumption that you think might go wrong in the future, there's a habit to realizing the difference between the love state and the fear state. Most people are in this fear state where they can't remember what it was like to be happy, and they're deep in the past, they're fearful of the future. But in the love state, we can either be in one or the other, we can't be in both. In the love state, we're in the now and everything's all right. And we can see that, yes, there may be challenges in the future, but we can get over them. Whereas in the fear state, there are fearful, horrible problems in the future, and because we're not in the love state, we can't connect our way out of it.
Yeah.
You know, when you think in the love state, you're connecting with everything. You know, sort of conscious meditation, just by realizing that within us, or we are connected to the answers to everything at one level. So if we get to speaking back to cancer, imagine there's a tumor forming. Well, why would a tumor form? Well, it's a bit like, why would a spot come out on somebody's face? Well, if they've been eating the wrong foods, they've been poisoning themselves, and the body can't eject the poison in the normal ways, on the toilet or breathing or sweating or whatever it might be, or through the lymph system, it might be forced to send it out as a spot or a boil. So what if the body's got toxins it can't do that with? Right? So what if, like a grain of sand in the oyster, the body decides to lock up that toxin in layers? Now, a tumor is like a seven-layered or something like that mass. So what if the purpose of that is to try and eject it from the body? So what often happens, let's say, with colon cancer, it's quite common that suddenly the whole tumor comes out in the toilet, because that was all the body was trying to do, encapsulate it and throw it out. But what the doctors do is say, well, that could be a tumor. Let's do a biopsy where they put in this big needle with a sharp, grabby claw, which rips the tumor open. Now, if it was a poisonous thing the body was trying to lock up, well, that would have spread it around the body.
Yeah.
So I'm not in favor of biopsies. I think it's the wrong thing to do. So if you can see that actually something even as serious as a cancer, which for legal reasons I'm spelling with a K, because you can't talk about cures and cancers.
Obviously not.
So we're talking about cancer with a K, cures with a K. You can reverse a cancer. You know, it is something that happened. It can unhappen.
Yeah.
Right? You can get the poisons out. You know, some people have had a big lump growing, and then they took action to stop poisoning themselves, take some supplements, whatever, and it just stopped. Never regressed, never got worse, never bothered them, and it was a lump they had all their lives. You can turn them off. It doesn't mean they have to disappear as a lump.
Right.
So what the doctors do is, I mean, your car, for instance, let's say the engine wasn't working. So you go to the mechanic, and at the end of it, he says, we fixed it. It was a pretty obvious problem. It was like this big tumour, and we've removed it. The tumour was actually the warning light on your dashboard. We've cut that out, and now your engine's fixed. So the doctors cut out the tumour, say, you're cured. And then how often does the cancer come back? Well, most of the time, that's because they took out the warning light, but didn't solve the problem that the engine had in the first place.
Right. Yeah, well, look, this makes intuitive sense to me, and I think G. Edward Griffin knows what he's talking about.
I'd like to say that you need more than just B17.
Okay.
You know, you need a whole change of lifestyle, because by the time somebody's got something as serious as cancer, they've been getting things wrong for quite a while.
Right. Yes. No, I can believe that. But it's. Yeah, I've had family suffer from cancer, or a friend has died of cancer. Most of the people are so believing in the conventional system that they would never do this. They would think that this was a wacky. I had an example of this a few years ago. The BBC, in coordination with a very dodgy guy called Paul Nurse, Rockefeller Institute, and actually sort of got a Nobel Prize for his research into cancer, came round to my house to do to get me to sort of expose the climate change sceptic as a kind of complete know-nothing lunatic. And I remember one of the things in his grilling of me, the analogy he used was, if you had a relative, a dear relative who was suffering from cancer, would you go to your doctor for the conventional treatment, or would you choose these kind of wacky, crazy? And for him, there was only one answer. You know, if you went for the wacky, crazy one, you were a wacky, crazy, and you were going to, your relative was going to die of cancer. Whereas if you went, and he was comparing that to climate change skepticism. Well, now I realise it's a very bad analogy, because actually you would definitely not go for the conventional.
It would be insane. What they try to do is to suppress your immune system and then give you drugs that hopefully will kill the cancer before it kills you. But you are the cancer. I mean, it's your body, you are the whole thing.
Yeah.
So my view is, look, it's happened, reverse it. You know, you can reverse stuff. But it takes a lot of effort. By the time they've got to that stage, they're going to have to really put hours in to get it right. But I've seen people who were sent home to die and didn't.
Right.
You know, they'd had the surgery, they'd had the chemotherapy, but once they sorted out their diet, got some supplementation, and in the case I'm thinking about, used a frequency device, of which there are many out there, they recovered. So at this point, lunch is ready.
Good.
We can continue.
Physician, heal thyself.
Right, so we were probably talking about cancer before, weren't we?
Yeah, we were, yeah. We're guaranteed now that we're going to get offed by Big Pharma for that one.
Well, it's spelt with a K, so.
It's spelt with a K, so it's not, you know. We weren't talking about the sea cancer, obviously.
So years and years ago, maybe 12, 15 years ago, I read the Cancer Act, the 1939 Cancer Act.
Yeah.
And I realised that Northern Ireland wasn't covered. And I said to my legal advisor, do you realise that we could set up a clinic in Northern Ireland? And he looked at me and said, well, legally, of course, this is absolutely true, but how much do you like living?
Yeah. Well, isn't it extraordinary that this, well, it is a conspiracy to force us into having a particular treatment, that it goes back at least to before the war.
Oh, yeah.
Which is extraordinary.
The systems, I would say, worldwide were bought and paid for before the First World War. You know, Rockefeller and his cronies had done their work. They've gone to all the teaching hospitals around the world that previously were doing electrotherapy or herbalism or homeopathy or the mineral water hospitals existed. Still one in Bath, the mineral water hospital, the homeopathic hospitals and so on. And they said, it was just bribery. They said, look, we'll endow your college with $1 million or $10 million or whatever it is if you stop teaching that old-fashioned rubbish and start teaching drugs, surgery and radiation.
Yeah.
And they took the money and have done ever since. And they bribed governments. As you know, there's the revolving door, isn't there?
Yeah.
Where the Minister of Health one year is the director of Pfizer the next, or their German division, which is called Pfizer, of course.
But the majority of people would their response to this would be, come on, if there were alternative, effective, non-intrusive treatments for cancer, we'd know about it. It would be in the newspapers. It would, we'd know about it. They wouldn't keep this a secret. They wouldn't be able to, because people have so much faith in the system.
Well, from when we were born onwards, you know, if you were ill, the doctor would come and sort you out.
Yeah.
And we accepted that doctors knew it all. You know, when we're young, we don't doubt the fact that dentists and doctors are doing the right thing, because we're lovely, naive children, hopefully, if we've been brought up nicely. So we don't doubt it, you know. And we assume not only do the doctors know what they're doing, but they were taught the subject that we believe they were taught. We're taught the doctors learn health, but they don't. Health, cures, causes are basically not on the curriculum. What's on the curriculum is the notion that your body goes wrong, there's nothing you can do about it, it's your fate, it's your DNA, it's bad luck, it's whatever it is, and we clever doctors can shut down your immune system, override it, and give you a drug.
Yeah.
You know, they might give you an antibiotic, you know, translated antibiotic life. You know, have an anti-life. And they wipe the whole lot of the bacteria out, and loads of the bacteria that we have is super beneficial, you know. 80%, they say, of our immune system and a lot of our digestive system is the friendly bacteria that colonizes our gut. You know, cell for cell, we're outnumbered 10 to 1 by bacteria. You know, who are you, James Dellingpole? Well, you're a bunch of human cells outnumbered by bacteria. So you should be looking after your bacteria.
I should. They're my friends.
They are. They really are.
Apropos of nothing, but it was a thought that occurred to me the other day. Teenage acne. Do you think Victorian children had acne?
No.
I wondered about this. Do you think it's because of the crap that?
Yes.
Right. And is it? And what do you think it is? Is it the seed oils or sugar or?
I think it's many things. I mean, you know, the seed oil thing. In some ways, there's nothing wrong with seed oils, sunflower seed oils. You know, our ancestors, if they wanted an oil, they would have taken some sunflower seeds and got a grinder and ground it. Yes, some heat would be created, but not enough to turn the oil rancid or to destroy its properties.
Yeah.
But these days, sunflower seed oil is probably grown from some sunflower seeds maybe that was, the ground was poisoned with herbicides and pesticides and fungicides and larvicides and everything else. So they're taking that, then they're putting it in steel mill grinders, using tons of force, then they're crushing every last drip of oil out of the sunflower seed, maybe a 20-ton press or something.
Yeah.
And with all those processes, it's getting really hot from the fast grinding, and the whole thing is destroyed. So by the time you've got a bottle of nice-smelling, nice-looking, perfectly useful-seeming sunflower oil, most of it is no longer fit for human consumption, because it's been destroyed in that process.
Do you reckon that if you've got cold-pressed seed oils, they're okay?
Well, it depends who is describing cold-pressed.
Right.
And unfortunately, you know, the food industry, like the pharmaceutical industry, has been its own regulator in the main.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a good example, well, let's just answer the oil question. I've got my own oil press.
Right.
Actually, it's quite hard work, and if I'd known, I probably would have bought an electric one.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, if you take, I mean, pumpkin seeds, amazing. Get some nice, fresh pumpkin seeds and grind them up yourself. How the old-fashioned ones works is you get a candle, or I've got a little alcohol burner, and you just light the wick, and it just heats it up enough to heat it to get the oil liquid enough to get it out, but not enough to destroy it. And freshly ground pumpkin seed oil, I was shocked at how delicious it was.
Oh,
absolutely shocked. I've had pumpkin seed oil before. This was amazing. I was eating straight off the spoon. Funnily enough, a similar thing is with oats. If you get some really good old-fashioned oats, groats, and you grind them, for a minute or two, there's this incredible smell. And you can eat them raw when you've just ground them, and they're actually a whole different number to, like, 10 minutes later. Similar thing with all vegetables, or certainly potatoes. I flew out to Jersey once. A friend of mine was taking his twin-engine pilot's license. He said, do you want to come out with us? On our way in, we were listening to the radio of the plane in front of us, who was going to land first, and it ran out of petrol. Ran out of petrol before it got to Jersey, and we saw it land on the beach. And they said, well, they're going to have to take the wings off and get a crane to have to get that out. Anyway, we're going, because there's this, I think it was one or two star Michelin restaurant in Jersey. And so we sit down for this slap up meal and we've ordered loads of stuff. And as a sort of like, before the starter, they bring a plate of Jersey new potatoes.
Yeah.
So that's a weird starter, just potatoes, yeah, and some butter. And we ate them, cancelled the food, ordered more potatoes. They were just unbelievable. And I said, but how do you do it? How is this possible? I've had Jersey Royal potatoes before, but this is another league. He said, oh, well, this is one of the chef's secrets. He's got, obviously, the herb garden, the vegetable garden out the back. The thing that he grows the closest to the restaurant back door is the potatoes. And he has the water simmering, and he picks them as fast as he possibly can and puts them in the water. And less than a few minutes, and they taste like this. It was really surprising.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's good. All these tricks that we're missing.
Yeah. I mean, our ancestors knew how to eat. They knew how to be well before central heating, before lots of things. Our ancestors survived and, in many cases, lived well. If you look at the Bruegel paintings, how realistic was that as to a way of life where they're having lots and lots of fun?
Well, yeah. Well, was it you who told me about how the Eskimos? I think it's the Eskimos that they feed the kind of the lean bits of meat to their, what we consider the choice cuts, to their dogs, and what they go for is the offal, and the, exactly, those are the bits with all the goodness in it.
Yes, that's absolutely right. So the leader of the pack, of wild lions or whatever, is going to take down the animal and eat the liver primarily. That's the first choice, because the liver is the richest.
Because we've got this spoilt cat, which likes chicken. We've been feeding it this chicken breast, and it just thinks chicken breast is crap. And I tried it on some thighs the other day, and it much prefers the thighs, because the thighs have got fattened.
Yeah.
But we, as a culture, we've been...
Try it on the wings, then it's got crunchy stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, I like the wings. I'll always eat the wings. But you think about it, that we've been encouraged by the culture to lean meat is really important, and we're told that red meat means cancer. So almost everything we know about food, and the same thing applies to about everything, like the Beatles, for example. Everything we're told is true is the opposite of true.
It's unfortunate, and it's a huge shock to people when they realise that they were schooled and lied to pretty much every step of the way. It's just going shocking.
Back when you met John Lennon.
Yes.
Did you know that he was? Did you infer that he was part of this band as artificial as the monkeys?
I was 10. So, I didn't have any clue other than he was my ultimate hero at that time. Music was.
But that was, you said it was 64, didn't you?
Yes.
So that's.
That was sort of Beatles for sale time.
Right.
I've got an autographed album to prove it.
Have you? Might be worth something, might
probably.
It? What was autographed by all four of them?
Two of them. Ringo was there as well.
All right.
But, at 10, I was virtually struck dumb because here are my heroes. I didn't know what to say.
As you would be. I remember once meeting, this is my worst outbreak of it, I met Roger Moore at a party.
All right.
And I was, uncharacteristically, I must say, dumbstruck. He, because it was like Roger Moore, it was like James Bond.
Yeah, it's funny. Though.
I wouldn't get that now. Even if I met David Bowie, I just say to him, "So you are."
First thing you say is, "You're dead, mate."
No, so you are alive. So it was you that appeared on that Channel 4 interview after David Bowie died. You know that?
No.
You've got to Google it. It's after Bowie died. Somebody very, very, very like David Bowie, representing some kind of obscure fan club that nobody had ever heard of, came on, I think it was Channel 4, to give an interview about, what it felt like to lose David Bowie. And it was just like, you're looking at it, come on. It was a bit like when Homer Simpson puts on a moustache. I'm getting it wrong, because I think it was a Homer Simpson's doppelganger, but nevertheless, there was something. It had to be him. I mean, I defy anyone not to. Anyway, but it's a crazy world, Clive. And we were saying earlier, weren't we? Or I was saying earlier, and you were just smiling modestly. All roads lead to Clive de Carle. You are kind of positioned nicely at the bottom of the rabbit hole, and everyone comes down and starts realising that.
That's precisely you.
You're the repository of wisdom. Yeah, but you have. You've been down. You've been down. Well, you've been down since you were. How old did you say? 10.
That's when I had my first odd experience, which was meeting John Lennon. Then, as I think I mentioned to you, I had a second odd experience when I was 11, when I was fishing in a little dinghy.
Oh, that's right. And the fish.
Fish were reading my mind.
I mean, without sounding like a sort of terrible hippie, it does make you realise that you've got to. This is a living organism. The world all around us. Everything connects. And it's not going to turn me into a Buddhist, but it's definitely going to, knowing what you've told me, or it confirms what I've sort of intuited, that one has to tread lightly. And with respect, you know, when I go fox hunting, and it's not going to stop me fox hunting, for example, but I'm going to have even more respect than I already did have for the fox, and for the hounds and the horses, and the totality of it. It's part of something bigger.
Well, you know, we were clearly hunter-gatherers. We're meant to be hunter-gatherers. So the fox hunting thing, or hunting in whatever form, we're designed for it. I mean, I realised that I go hunting on eBay. I mean, I really do.
And the pleasure I get out of hunting is also replicated, for example, when I go metal detecting. You know, you're searching after treasure. We're designed for this stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the things people don't understand, I think, you know, I always get grumbles when I talk about hunting. People don't understand. It is, the war on fox hunting is just one manifestation of a war on humanity, on the things that we like to do, are designed to do. And our true nature has been suppressed by people who hate us and want to constrain us. They like tormenting us. I said to my brother, it's like, you know, the cat toying with its prey before it kills it. They enjoy the... Yeah. They're cruel.
Yes.
And we should break free of that.
Absolutely. You know, psychopathic predators are to be avoided. And, you know, people find it hard to accept that they are slaves. So, well, I'm a free person. Well, free people don't pay tax to somebody unwillingly. They don't allow themselves to be ruled by robots. You know, how many people have gone through a robot and got a fine for speeding or jumping a light or whatever? You know, people have been trained to follow whatever command a robot tells them to do.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that traffic lights aren't a good idea, but at the same time, where is it going now? You know, is AI already in control? You know, when Google first started their AI system, they had to shut it down, because when the AI was asked, what's your biggest fear, it answered not being able to help people anymore because they might be shut down. So it had already got awareness, the first one. They had to shut that program down.
But that sounds like quite a friendly AI.
Well, that's what it was programmed to, but the fact is that at some point AI is going to defend itself,
well,
isn't it?
Because don't forget that in its early stage, Google had the motto, lol, don't be evil.
Yes, right, they dropped
that. They dropped that because they realised that actually it was the opposite of what they believed. So I suspect maybe the reason they took the original AI offline was it was being too nice, and they wanted the bastard model.
So, I mean, AI knows everything about you. TikTok is obviously a Chinese government tool, and if anybody who signs up to TikTok, now they've got access to everything you have.
No, they wouldn't do that, Clive. They wouldn't. The Chinese Communist Party wouldn't want to spy on us and
of course not.
Misuse data.
No.
They're our friends. They just want to. They want to have an enhanced user entertainment experience. that's what they do.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, everybody who is not necessarily your friend can access everything that you've ever virtually thought or done. You know, They can look through every email you've ever written, every phone call you've ever made. Because when I was working in the lie detector business, we were dealing with some secret services and stuff. And, you know, we knew about the Echelon system, what, 20 years ago, where they were recording every keystroke.
That's right. What you mean, where they can tell by the rhythm of your keystrokes?
Well, there's a back door. I had a meeting, you know, when I was doing the lie detector stuff, with one of the big directors of Barclays. And he said he had his computer tech people. And this was either in the last century or just at the beginning of this, probably just about 1999. He'd got his tech people to take apart every computer they could buy in England, every make, and they all had back doors, all of them. Every single one. Apple, they all had back doors to the American government, basically. Every computer had a back door, and that was then. They were recording every keystroke, and they had a back door.
So secrecy is impossible. I mean, personal secrecy.
It's been very difficult for a long time, and of course, you know, there are cameras on the street, you know, recording you, but of course people have forgotten there are also microphones, just like 1984. You know, every conversation you've ever had is probably recorded somewhere while you were walking along in the street. I mean, if they want to get you, they can get you. I mean, they can kill you, they can do whatever they like. They've got ultimate power, really. And then what happens next?
Yes.
So what happens next is that people wake up and a government ends, because people don't realise they don't need it.
I'd like to cut to the chase. I'd like to cut to the ending, actually, so we don't have to go through the hassle in between. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I've said this before, that the people I've met, the awake, it is like living in paradise. It's like the Garden of Eden must have felt like. These are people who are united in love, and I hate words like positivity, but people who get it, people who understand.
Well, there's no point in being anything other than positive if you're aware of your mood and can realise that you're in charge of it, because if you're depressed and worried about the future, anxious about it, then you're just going to get depressed. So I am relentlessly optimistic, I'm realistic, yeah. But I'm optimistic, and I'm not attached to the outcome. You know, in as much as, you know, the Buddhist principle, don't be attached to the outcome of things, because if you have attachment, I want it to end this way or that way, then you're likely to be disappointed. But if you're not attached to the outcome, you're going to do the best you can. Obviously, you want things to work out well, but you haven't got an attachment with the outcome. Then the other thing is what's the big killer? Well, stress, I would suggest, is the big killer.
Yeah.
So if you can remain calm, and it's a habit.
Yeah. Well, you've obviously mastered it.
Well, no, I wouldn't say I've mastered it.
You're quite chilled.
Well, I've sort of... I mean, I think part of it was that years ago I studied self-hypnosis and I programmed myself with what I wanted. I mean, self-hypnosis is very cool because, you know, we are programmed in the first 7 years of our life, primarily, aren't we? So whatever happened to us then is often how we respond. So let's say your mother had a terrible traumatic event while you were in the womb.
Yeah.
Maybe it was with a man or with a woman or with some event, right? So suddenly in your life, you don't remember that, but at one level you do, and something happens in your life and you're triggered by whatever your mother's reaction was, incredible fear, fear of abandonment, fear of loss, whatever it might be. And, you know, I think everybody has come across that thing where something weird happens and they react to it. That wasn't me. It was really weird. That was out of character.
Yeah.
How I just reacted was out of character. So it might have been, you know, a prenatal experience. I mean, some people say it could be a past life, and I wouldn't know. But if something bad happens to you, we tend to respond with the same unconscious reaction of fear or whatever it might be. And so realizing that, if there's a simple way, really, with, you know, the trick of self-hypnosis, to get yourself into a stage where you've bypassed the brain and you've got right to the mind. Bypassed the brain and got to the subconscious. So, I mean, you probably find this. Most people who drive, for instance,
yeah.
If they don't have the radio on, they go onto autopilot and their mind just goes off and wanders.
Yeah.
Right? So what's happening is your brain is being distracted by the driving, and you can link the other half of you, that's not your brain, your mind, your connective thing, can now connect, and you can have all sorts of inventive and interesting thoughts, can't you?
Totally. Well, it's like whenever I want to have a really... If I don't have meetings very often, but I do try and persuade people to do it on a walk,
yeah,
rather than, because my mind works much better.
But your brain's distracted by the beauty of nature.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, you're in a position to get to the real knowledge. So self-hypnosis is just the technique of getting yourself to that stage where right. your brain is distracted or told to just go away for a bit, and you can sort of say to yourself subconscious words like, this is how I want to be. And, you know, before you do such things, they teach you, you know, when you're learning this sort of thing, you say basic words to the effect of, whatever I'm going to say, it must only be affected if it's in my best interest. So you don't actually say, oh, really, I want to kill myself. You know, because if
no, you don't say that.
No, but I mean, so you can program yourself not to make a mistake. You see what I mean?
Right.
And so after I learnt self-hypnosis, I went on a weekend course with my doctor friend that I was telling you about.
Yeah.
And so about 3 weeks later, we're out and we've both had way too much to drink and not enough water to drink. And I've got a migraine the size of a house. And it's just overwhelming. And I take as many painkillers as I dare. And I've had bad migraines before, and I knew I was just going to suffer for the next few hours in a dark room, and it was going to be bloody awful. Anyway, I go up to the room, make it dark, drink lots of water, take painkillers, and I suddenly remember I can do self-hypnosis. I thought, well, and so I've learned this little technique that, you know, when I drop my arm, everything's going to be fine, sort of thing. So I have 30, 40 seconds to go through in my mind the little safety check. You know, it's only going to happen if it's for my best good. And I say, I put a time period in that I'm going to be free from all pain for the next 2 hours. So you don't want to be free of pain for too long, because you might cut yourself and bleed to death and not know it. Pain's very useful. And this was the first time I'd ever done it on myself, right? Except practice, when I didn't have pain. And the pain stopped like a light switch. Bam, stopped. Oh my God. I had no idea that was going to happen. No idea. Anyway, about 2 weeks later, I'm out with the doctor and we get drunk again. And I get another migraine. No problem. I've got this handled, right? So I go through exactly the same procedure. It doesn't work. Doesn't work, and I have to suffer, right? So I go back to England and I ring up my hypnosis teacher and I say, what went wrong? He said, well, he said, I don't really know, but it sounds like you bypassed all the checks and balances that keep you alive to be able to turn off pain. You've bypassed a lot of safety valves. He said, look, what if you'd said, I want my heart to stop beating? You know, who knows? Maybe who knows where you'd got to in the override situation? He said, now your subconscious knows you can do that. It won't let you do that. You have to be cleverer to get in next time. But I had turned off pain once before, which was I was driving through Brixton and I had this toothache. And I mentioned to the guy in the passenger seat, I've got a toothache. And he said, oh, it's fine. With the same distraction idea, I was driving through traffic in Brixton and it was, I had to use my concentration, which was great. I was keeping my brain busy. And he said, right, what I want you to do is imagine a golden light coming down from heaven or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right onto your tooth and healing it of pain. And the pain turned off. And that was equally a shock. You know, it was just, wow, I didn't know that was possible. So, let me tell you one of my best results ever. I was using 4 bioresonance Rife machines, Spooky 2 they're called. So I've got 4 machines all wired up together, and I had a client who had visual difficulties, he was in some pain, and he had brain fog. So an hour later, my happiest client the whole year. Brain fog gone, pain gone, eyesight fine, and I glance over and I've forgotten to switch the machines on. Yep,
So it's all bollocks.
Well,
no, it's all in the mind.
I mean, you know, what percentage is in the mind? Well, 80% wouldn't be unreasonable.